This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn-Mark Roshan-Kennison and Noel Lim. It's 6 o'clock in the morning, Tuesday the 14th of July. And how are you both this morning? How was your Monday?
The Monday was good. Really busy Monday, as always. But yeah, looking forward to the rest of the week.
Monday was actually a good start to the day, but it was a day. I was watching Parliament, and it was
Parliament was exciting, wasn't it?
A dramatic day, truly. I mean, and this was even before any of the motions were passed. We're just talking about opening statements and question time, and it was an event. I was getting memes sent to me about circus and then a picture of Parliament in the background. It was quite something. But I think we know the news most of the time. At the end of the day, the speaker was replaced, and it was a very, very tight numbers there. 111 to 109.
One abstention and one absence.
Very close, but we'll be talking about that later in the day.
We will indeed, because we're going to be taking a look at the front pages of the newspapers later on at about 6:45. But before that, what do we have later on after the 6:30 news?
Right, so you know how we were talking about Florida's Disneyland was opening up yesterday morning. Now, it looks like Hong Kong's Disneyland is about to close. Now, to Disney, Hong Kong isn't the biggest gem in their arsenal over there, but it is a sign that things are getting a bit worse in Hong Kong, because this is all part of the part of Hong Kong's measures to kind of contain the virus. They're a bit concerned about it, so we'll get into that in about half an hour.
And well, you know what's really on people's minds are employment, right? Job cuts, salary cuts. So now this discussion is on job guarantees. Is that something we should pursue?
Right, and if you want to weigh in on our conversations, remember you can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Up next, we're asking the question of cities and whether or not they're still a hub of opportunity. So stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn, Roshan and Noel. That was Buddy Miles with Dreams. And, you know, speaking of dreams, when you're young and starry-eyed, just starting out, you know, what do you dream of? You dream of money, career, a white picket fence with 2.5 kids. And usually, you know, the old wisdom is that you come to the city to get a job and be successful and get that white picket fence. You know, that's the old wisdom.
I don't know where you see white picket fences in Malaysia, Lynn.
It's a figment of, it's a figure of speech, right? Is that really the case anymore? Now, MIT has done a study, obviously based in America, but I think that the results are quite applicable to most cities around the world nowadays, showing that urban centres like KL are no longer really beneficial for those working in kind of the middle level management positions. Rather, they are beneficial more for those who are in more higher paid, high skilled jobs, because everything else has kind of been either pushed out or automated.
Yeah, so this is a situation where, income inequality has increased and home prices have gone up dramatically. So you have a situation where people cannot afford to stay in a proper place and, you know, their income levels are dropping. And also the fact that more people are going to universities, and so competition for jobs have obviously increased, and this has reduced opportunities even for people without a college degree, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, now people with a college degree may be doing a non-college degree kind of job. So you have that kind of situation in the urban cities. But bear in mind, this study is done in the US, but as a matter of time, Malaysia will be facing this situation as well.
Yeah, I think it's also just about where the city is in its life cycle, right? If you are part of the growth of the city, like Putrajaya was 30 years ago, you know? And I think this is just anecdotal. I'm not an MIT professor or anything like that. But just watching my parents who moved from different parts of the country to Putrajaya because they were studying at University of Malaya. And the city really grew around University of Malaya after that. That was the growth and prosperity of that generation, right? That's when Putrajaya became what it was today. When they bought their house, if you compare it to their salaries at that point, it was incredibly affordable compared to the purchasing power that we have today in terms of just simply buying a house. There are other comparisons to be made. There are different, the times are better or worse now. That really is down to perspective. But that affordability and that growth phase, I guess conventional economics will make you think that, oh, demand, supply, maybe it's time to move to another city, move out of Putrajaya, mm-hmm. go build a new city somewhere else where you can have better growth prospects. But
be part of the earlier part of that city's
life correct.
Cycle. Yes,
correct. Be right. of the growth. I mean, but then with the earlier part of any life cycle, there's mm-hmm. also that 50-50 chance, or more than 50-50 chance, that project will fail, right? But everyone, the established cities have become even more, even stronger. The bigger have gotten bigger, and we're just sticking around.
So this is where I think the work from home kind of revolution comes in, right? Because we've been talking a lot about, you know, tips and tricks to work from home. Is it going to revitalize our property sector? How is it going to change the way we choose our houses? And I think it's really going to reshape how cities are developed, because it's no longer the case that you had to physically be present and, you know, commute every day and fight the traffic jams to get into Kuala Lumpur, for example, or even in other cities in the US. It would be what, San Francisco or the center of LA. It's you can do your job from the comfort of your couch. And I think a lot more companies are becoming more receptive to that idea that, you know, their workers can be productive and accessible even when they're no longer physically present. So what is that going to mean for cities as we know them today? You know, are they going to continue to just grow, sustained by their existing growth trajectory, or are they going to evolve to kind of fit this new narrative?
Yeah, so I think the question is quite a complicated one. You know, just moving out of the city may not be the solution, because you have to think about your children. Where do they go to schools? Are there good schools outside the city, right? And then once you take the children out of the city, your social network then will be, your social capital will be really the place where you live, and it's not in the city. And are you denying your children, you know, that kind of access to better schooling, better networks, and so forth? So these are also considerations that need to be taken into account. So it depends on maybe what age you are in, where your children are almost finishing school and you can, you know, they will be going to college soon, and then maybe you think, okay, I will move out. And I think the Financial Times has written a number of articles where people are now looking at properties outside London. Of course, it's quite common, I think, for people to just commute, but I think increasingly more people are open to the idea of just having a second home or just moving out completely.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing this article points out is one, you know, those jobs, the digital revolution, again, benefits the same people that are benefited by the cities, right? The high-paying jobs, because the jobs that have been automated away, things like manufacturing or clerical work, that's been digitized and moved away and to different areas. They can't benefit from digitalization. That's and they the high likelihood that they may not have the facilities to do that, even if they had access to it. So it's a bit of a conundrum there, right? Because how do you then the issue here is jobs. People can't get good jobs because we've automated a lot of it away, especially the baser things like retail jobs, right? Now I think in America, retail accounts for a massive amount of jobs there, and as we increasingly start to go e-commerce, and now with the pandemic, all these retail jobs are out, right? We move online. Who is going to, where are you going to put these people? They need jobs, right? They haven't been educated. The gap to get to a higher level of education is significant. Where do you fill that gap?
Yeah, so I think on an individual level, you have to constantly upskill or reskill and, you know, consider the five-year trajectory. Where do you want to be? What are you going to be doing? And, you know, is even the possibility of holding down multiple jobs, right? So I see, you know, many young people, sometimes they don't, they get into another kind of, having a side business. It's not because they may really need the money, but the fact they just like to have this diversified portfolio of income.
It's that flexibility, I think, that you have to really, really embrace when it comes to working in this current day and age. You can't. It's no longer the case where you lock into a single job and then you're going to be doing that job for 30 years and you're never going to branch outside of it. There is the high likelihood that you may switch sectors or switch trajectories, and you have to be able to adapt to that.
See, I'm not worried about you, me, people like us, because I think we understand that. I worry about the kids I see in some of the homes that my family does some work with, right? Who have no semblance of what Zoom is, don't understand the internet, and who are really going to struggle. The gap is just getting wider and wider. And it really concerns me, because how are you going to protect these? They're going to grow up and they're going to have to be in no man's land. And that's who I'm concerned about. And that's just something I've been thinking about, especially after, I think, Andrew Yang brought up the whole freedom dividend thing when he was talking about it, because he's bringing in from an American perspective, but maybe universal basic income, there is a case to be made there in the longer run for humanity at large, not to sound too dramatic there.
Well, let us know what you think. You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Our cities still hubs of opportunity. Let us know what you think. We have some messages coming up and then we're going to be taking a look at job guarantees. So stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. That was Don't You Know by Durand Jones and The Indications. And you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn, Roshan and Noel. It's 6.20 a.m. Tuesday, the 14th of July. And I mean, earlier we were talking a little bit about, you know, jobs and employment and how this is going to change as we head into kind of the digital revolution. How is it going to impact our cities? But there's this idea that's been circulating now, particularly in Australia. It's back in vogue. And it's the idea of job guarantees. Now, we've heard about them. Probably some of us in uncertain positions would love to have them. And what it is it's essentially an unconditional job offer at minimum wage to anyone willing and able to work. Effectively, it's a kind of a subsidized jobs scheme.
So I think it works in the short term. You might just need that because this is quite an unusual situation, right, that we find ourselves in. You know, businesses, the economy has come to a halt thanks to the pandemic and lockdowns. So that might work, especially for graduates coming out of universities and needing a job because, you know, one thing though, you know, governments want to keep the electorate happy, right? You know, hungry voters don't make happy voters. Yeah, so I think it works in the short term. But in the long term, of course, there's always this question, you know, are you going to be interfering with market forces? And that might not be good. God knows how long are we talking about, because it's really now a buyer's market, an employer's market, and we might have to wait for about a year or so for, you know, for such schemes to continue.
You know, whenever we talk about market forces nowadays, I can't help but just be like, we've thrown it out. I mean, just think about how much the Federal Reserve has done to the real, to the stock markets of the world. The fact that it's gone directly in buying ETFs and bonds, market forces have been thrown out the window at this point. Everyone is just trying to make sure that we don't go into a Great Depression and trying all sorts of different things. Economics is not a science, right? A lot of times it's really an art, and these things that we established as rules and principles are really all just ongoing theories that they're all theories that we are ongoing trying to prove or disprove and all of that. So really, if you, on the macro scale, we're all just learning on the go. But just as a just talking back to this, right? This is a program from Australia. Now, Australia's minimum wage is on the federal level $19.84. Malaysia's is 6 or 7 ringgit, if I remember. I used to work as a barista, and that's how much I was being paid at that point.
I got paid 4 ringgit an hour.
Okay, that's atrocious. Wow. Okay, but essentially, that really one thing is the purchasing power in Australia is better, right? And on top of that, you're being paid $19-$20 an hour. I had friends who were studying in Australia who did just work at cafes, and that was enough to cover their living expenses. The tuition was, I mean, their parents paid for tuition. They had to cover their living expenses. So it really is a different dynamic, right? Australia has approached the social fabric a little differently. They've made sure that the minimum wage is a certain level. And yes, things are more expensive there, but I've always believed in the concept that if you're paid more, you have more choices to what to do with that money, as opposed to having cheaper things but less money to buy the things that you want to actually buy.
You know, in Malaysia, right, we do have some form of a job guarantee in some sense, but they're more like job placement. So I think that One Malaysia Latihan scheme, One Malaysia scheme Latihan. So that's something that was, you know, mooted really to, you know, just kind of like keep unemployed youth employed, especially if they came from universities. So I think it comes down to this, right? So these are things you mentioned this earlier, the universal basic income. And we're not just talking about young people. What about, you know, people who are caught in the net, right? You know, they are not skilled enough, or, you know, they're just caught in that skills gap. Do we provide a universal basic income till they get back onto a more stable footing? So these are, you know, some questions that need to be asked.
Yeah, so I think some of these previous programs that have been experimented before, you know, in Australia in the 80s particularly, these were targeted at the long-term unemployed. So if you've been unemployed for more than 18 months, then you qualify for this program. And I think it's actually a pretty decent idea for targeted groups. So the long-term unemployed, perhaps the youth also that have been unemployed for a significant period of time. Because, you know, I think a lot of graduates now are kind of caught in that trap of you come out of university, somehow or other, your qualifications aren't enough to get you a job. And yet all of the jobs require some form of experience. So, you know, you want to get a job for the experience, but you also can't get a job because you don't have experience. And so this would kind of solve that little conundrum that a lot of us are facing, while, of course, we also have to address the larger problem of the fact that our education system doesn't seem to cater to the demands of the labour market.
Yeah, so I think what has happened, instead of providing job guarantees or, you know, a minimum income, that's obviously something to be looked at. Now, in this phase that we are in, you know, just even subsidising students to get onto courses, right, online mm-hmm. courses. MDEC, for example, has a scheme for that.
Yeah, MDEC has given up, I think, 3,800 courses to those who are unemployed. This is a partnership by the government with Coursera. So if you are unemployed, go and check out those programs.
All right. And you can also tell us what you think. You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. You can help us answer the question of whether a job guarantee would help solve our unemployment problems. But right now we are heading into the 6:30 news bulletin. But first we have a Jeepster by T-Rex. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Can't Change Me by Chris Cornell, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Mark, Roshan Kanisen and Noel Lim. It is just barely 6:40 in the morning, Tuesday the 14th of July. We're taking a look at some stories from around the world this morning. Now, yesterday, we were talking about the fact that the happiest place on earth has reopened once again in Florida. But over in Hong Kong, it looks like that happy place is going to be shut down yet again. So that's going to close on Wednesday. Day in order to comply with a government rollback of public activities after they saw a spike in coronavirus infections.
Yeah, so Hong Kong put out some new rules, right? And one of them, some pretty big things here. One being that all public transport passengers required to wear masks, with offenders facing up to a 5,000 Hong Kong dollar fine if they don't. Ban on dine-in services from 6 p.m. until 5 a.m. with only 4 people allowed per table. Closure of bars and 12 other types of premises. And this is where Hong Kong Disneyland comes into the picture. Scaling back public gatherings from 50 people to 4. That's a big scale back, big change there. And essentially that they are concerned after they saw a spike in cases, and they're just trying to get in front of the situation, I guess. But yeah, so I mean, to Disney, Hong Kong Disneyland isn't the biggest gem in their portfolio of parks, but it is an overall concern, I guess, in terms of how do you move things back. Is this going to be the state of affairs where a spike then leads to systematic shutdown of the economy again?
It's an indicator, right? Because China, Hong Kong, Macau, they were all some of the early areas to kind of bring the coronavirus infections under control. And now that they're potentially facing a second wave, it's something that companies will be very wary of.
Yeah, so Hong Kong is responding very swiftly to this situation. The health minister also will be empowered to require passengers from specific high-risk countries to present a negative test result before they can actually board flight to Hong Kong, and the airlines will also be penalized if they fail to ensure compliance. And so I think 11 of the latest infections were imported, so I think obviously Hong Kong needs to take stringent action. I think in the case of Malaysia, right, I think we've also had some imported cases, so I think all this means that you know, the borders are not going to open so quickly, or you know, really very much more stringent you know, actions have to be taken.
Yeah, the bureaucracy involved in traveling is going to be significant, I think, going forward, because you can control a lot within your country. You can mm-hmm. manage the situation well within your country, but if the other countries aren't doing on par of a job, or if the other countries are as big as Indonesia or India, where it's a situation that's very difficult to manage just because of how fragmented the nation is, or even if you're a country like the United States, a developed country, even there it's very fragmented in the way they do it. So how do you move, how do you start opening up borders again? We've talked about travel bubbles before, mm-hmm. But then you're going to have to be selective. And then I can foresee some of the guidelines here that Hong Kong has used, they're being used by other nations as well, because essentially you're going to have to keep someone accountable. And if you can't keep the individual for accountable, you can keep the airline accountable, because they're going to want to protect their bottom line.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the concern at the end of the day is also that these travel bubbles could be used as an avenue for kind of political statements, right? So let's say you don't like the policies introduced by government A on other issues, you know, unrelated to COVID-19, that could surface as a refusal to accept their tourists or a refusal to fly to their country. You know, there are a lot of I think elements at play when it comes to talking about reopening kind of pathways to the rest of the world. And, you know, politics is nevertheless very present, even amidst this pandemic situation. Now, a good case in point here is the US and China, because, you know, as the tensions between these two sides mount, the Chinese government announced on Monday that it's going to impose sanctions on three American lawmakers and a diplomat in retaliation for similar moves last week that the Trump administration made against four officials in China.
Two American lawmakers and a diplomat sounds like a TV show. It really does. I could foresee myself watching something like that. I mean, there is a place in my heart for a replacement for House of Cards. But the tensions between the US and China are just growing, right? Anyone who talks about, oh, we are entering a Cold War. No, we entered a Cold War between these two nations a long time ago.
In 2019. And, you know, it seems like...
Or even before that, maybe.
Yeah, true. It seems like it was going to subside, I think, when a phase one trade deal was signed. But then COVID-19 happened, and that appears to be all out the window again.
Yes, and Trump has said that phase two is not his priority, or rather he tweeted that. So, you know, so
there we go again. Statement.
We start all over again. But even if Joe Biden wins the elections, you know, Joe Biden's not exactly all that warm to China either, but probably more friendly and maybe more constructive. But, you know, as I see this tit for tat kind of sanctions, it's not going to take us anywhere, right? Right, you know, it's just going to be a lose-lose situation.
Yeah, but of course, all this has really escalated because of the situation in Hong Kong and the security law, right? That's something that we can't ignore. The tech trade war and the techno-nationalism, as we've been calling it now, that's all been played across the world. But really, what's really sparked off, really escalated things between the two of them is the security law in Hong Kong. They're not too happy about it.
Hong Kong is just the pawn, right, in the game. Mm.
Yeah, but it's a very powerful pawn to use, right? It's the symbol that it presents, that it's a democracy, it's a financial center, and you're not supposed to be imposing your laws on this tiny nation yet, anyway.
But Hong Kong isn't a tiny nation. It's a special administrative region under China.
There we go, right? But there's supposed to be a transition period, mm-hmm. which has been escalated. So it really, the optics from it looks, it's very, it's good for the US in this sense. But yeah, you know, when we talked, Noel, you mentioning Joe Biden, the US as a whole has become China hawkish, right? Just degrees of hawkishness. And constructiveness is the key word. I think the Democrats will be more constructive. Trump just likes to tweet his expressions out very as and when he pleases.
There are a lot of underlying issues, I think, between the US and China. So one of it is trade. Another is this fear over China imposing its laws on what is perceived as a free and democratic area. But there's also the issue of the Uyghur Muslims in Xinjiang, which is what this particular spat, you know, was sparked off of. Not likely to be resolved anytime soon, so we'll just have to wait and see. But do let us know what you think. Nevertheless, you can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We've got some messages coming up for you, and then we're taking a look at the front pages of the newspapers. So stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Two Steps Behind by Def Leppard, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn, Roshan and Noel. 6:52 a.m, Tuesday the 14th of July, and we have the front pages of the newspapers and the portals in front of us this morning to give you a bit of insight into what's happening on the news. I have the NST in front of me, and the headline here is PN passes critical vote test. So this was the motion to remove the Dewan Rakyat speaker, which was carried by a very slim margin of 111 votes to 109. And I think that's on the front pages of all the papers this morning, isn't it?
Yes, the Star it has this big headline here, House of Art and Drama. And Arts is the play Arts Harun's, the new speaker, Dato' Azhar Azizan Harun. So it was really a fiery day for him on the first day of Dewan Rakyat, where, a few things happened. Shah Alam MP Khalid Samad, he had to leave. He was asked to leave the house just 10 minutes after the new speaker, Azhar, was was sworn in. And Prime Minister Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin explains why the COVID-19 stimulus package needed to be implemented without it being tabled in Parliament first, and he was really replying to Dato' Sri Anwar Ibrahim's question, and also accusations of sexist and racist remarks fly across the floor.
Yeah, I mean, I've never really watched Parliament, and I was quite excited to watch yesterday's proceedings. It was, it didn't let me down in terms of entertainment value. But it was quite concerning because, you couldn't get a point across a lot of the times. There was a lot of ruckus. I was getting memes of basically calling Parliament a circus. That's what pictures were being sent around. It was concerning to see, you had people who were trying to make good points who were just being heckled. And that's not to say it was from one side, because, yes, Khalid Samad was sent out, but he was not exactly the most, professional of MPs also during the Parliament sitting. But he's not the only one. There were plenty of people who were participating in the heckling overall. But the concerning things, that's one thing, right? But the concerning things was just the appointment of the new speaker without the vote. I think that was something that was really gathering some headlines and some attention there. And more importantly, I think for me, it's just the establishment of the lines, right? So you had the vote for the speaker to vacate the position, and it came down to 111 to 109. Now, that's not a strong majority by any means, really. And one absentee and one abstained, if I'm correct, which means that we could be looking at an era of hung parliaments.
Yeah, it's going to be a very interesting time indeed as we head into the rest of this sitting, because the sitting doesn't end today, doesn't end tomorrow. It ends at the end of August. And there are a lot more items on the agenda that we can look forward to seeing coming out of this parliamentary sitting. So if I flip through the NST, the first three pages are on the parliament sitting. So looking at the swearing in of the new Dewan Rakyat speaker, as well as comments from Dato' Azhar Azizan Harun, saying that he has no regret in accepting the speaker's post despite criticism from the opposition bloc. So it's an interesting time. But if you look even further into the paper, there's an article here on page 5, parents set to send kids back to school. And that's because tomorrow schools reopen after a 3-month break, so primary and secondary schools. And I think this is going, there is a lot of nervousness, I'm sure, about this move, because anyone's really that confident that children will be able to follow all of the SOPs, in the face of coming back to school with your friends. I mean, certainly adults can't do it a lot of the time.
And it's certainly very stressful for the teachers as well, right? Because they are floating from class to class, running their classes. So that's also, and the school principals as well. And on a darker note, The Star has reported this: 90 domestic abuse cases in Selangor. Domestic violence cases were reported to the Selangor Welfare Department throughout the initial months of the movement control order. 10, the highest number of cases were recorded in Kota Anggerik constituency. Just 10 cases alone there. So hopefully there will be some intervention by the state government.
Yeah, I think this is something we were also seeing during the MCO, right? And especially resources were being focused elsewhere, but it was really quite sad to hear these things.
Yes, so it just, the MCO, what the MCO did was it basically shone a light on some of the fissures within our society and the problems that we still need to address. But right now we're heading into the 7 o'clock news bulletin, and up next we're going to be bringing you more business news and analysis, so be sure to stay tuned to BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.